knocking on wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. Tonight I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and falling down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, if you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in the falling down key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. And you're running down my country, man. You're walking on the right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. That's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. With lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, lots more news for our people today. I'm going to play the show that we that Ken Givenin and William Johnson and I recorded back on Monday. This was the Ethnostate show, which we do every week, once a week, and it's up on BitChute. And this is the Ethnostate with Ken and William Johnson and myself, and with a number of stories, including what's wrong with it's okay to be white. Interesting issue that arose in Scotland a week ago, I guess.
Hello, everyone. This is William Johnson, chairman of the American Freedom Party, with another edition of The Ethnostate with Ken Givenin and Paul Frome. Thank you guys for joining me. I understand that with your sartorial attire, it's seasonal. What have you got on?
I've got my Father Christmas tie on. Father Christmas is what they call Santa Claus in Britain. And I've had this tie since Moses was a pup, or more or less, and I wear it every Christmas for Christmas dinner, and then I have a party for my political friends. We call it the Too Late for Christmas, Too Early for New Year's party. It's somewhere in that stretch, so I was wearing it for that. So it's part of the tradition.
Well, yesterday I went to church at a big Christmas function, and my wife said, well, be sure to wear a Christmas tie, and I couldn't find a Christmas tie, so I put on a St. Patrick's Day tie, and she made me take it off, so I had to just put on, I had a bow tie that was red, and I hadn't tied a bow tie in a couple of years, so it was all skewampus, but I tied that on. I would prefer the green St. Patrick's Day tie, but I couldn't wear it. So in any event, I understand you just got back from Japan. Tell us all about that.
Yes, this is not my first visit to Japan, but I have formed a very positive impression. I spoke to the a nationalist group called the Japan First Party. It was a very good, attentive audience. I would say quite mixed in terms of ages, all nicely dressed people. And I had an extremely good translator. So I did a speech pretty much about the Great Replacement. I was asked to talk about immigration and multiculturalism as an effect of Canada. And I'm always, you know, sensitive to whatever I say. It must be understandable to a foreign audience. There's no point in talking too much, shock that's, just parochially Canadian. But I've got a great response. Their party leader is a dynamic man named Sakurai, and he's running for, as far as I can gather, it's like the governor of Tokyo Prefecture, or it's a fairly big office. I was interested about how they will campaign, and they don't have a lot of money, but they do a lot of campaign through the social media and the internet. They have protests on various things. They're very down on the Korean immigrant and Chinese immigration that's coming in, and he says that their government simply lies to them. The West thinks that Japan takes hardly anybody. That's unfortunately not true. Another thing they're very engaged in is fighting something called pachinko parlors. And pachinko parlors, I've been by them a number of times, I've never been in one, but it's like glorified slot machines. And technically, according to Japanese law, that's not gambling, although really it is. They're pumping money in, hoping they get money out. And their objection is, their objections are several, but one is that the pachinko parlors are owned by, a lot of them, by foreign or gangster money. South Korea, even North Korea, is somehow in on it. So they feel that this is detrimental to the Japanese spirit. So I was very impressed with them.
How many people were there that you spoke to?
There were about 100 people at the lecture, and then they had a year-end party at a restaurant some distance away. And I said there were probably about 200 people at that. And I, along with the party leader and the translator, went from table to table and said a few words, and there's some smiles, and I was quite pleased, impressed by what I saw. The other thing that impressed me is, and I may have mentioned this last week, is Christmas is fairly widely noted there. A lot of Christmas lights and things like that, magnificent displays of lights, but also Merry Christmas on the front of department stores. And we have this battle in North America to get our institutions to acknowledge the feast that the vast majority of Canadians and Americans celebrate, whether from a religious point of view, if you're a Christian, or from a secular point of view, even if you're not particularly churched. The vast majority of people, including many non-whites, celebrate the spirit of Christmas. Well, why it should be so impossible for our establishment elite to gag out those words Christmas, I don't know, but it's part of a long-range attack on our institution.
Yeah, that's true. Well, let me digress a little bit and tell you a little bit about pachinko. What pachinko is what they would do is, it's the most boring game in the world. You put money in, and then you just flip, and the little balls go around like those little pin balls, only it's vertical, and it just goes through little slots. And when it goes through the right slots, you win more balls. And then you gather the balls up into a cup, and then you take it, and you turn it in for prizes, such as cigarettes or Cupid dolls or little things. And see, Japan is very much governed by what's on the face of the law. The face of the law says that you cannot gamble for money. So what they do is they they get cigarettes or they get other prizes, and then they go outside and they go around the corner to the alleyway, and there's a little booth in there, and they turn in and they sell the cigarettes or the Cupid dolls for money, and then they put the money and they go away. But that's okay with Japan because it's not gambling for money. They're gambling for prizes, and then you got the wife over there taking the money and taking the prizes and giving the money. But I represented a client who purchased the Dunes Hotel in Las Vegas, and he was a pachinko manufacturer. And of course, he had a Japanese name. He lived in Japan for a couple of generations, but he was Korean. And we bought the Dunes Hotel, and he couldn't make it work, so he ended up selling it to the Mirage, and they tore it down, and they sold the golf course. Mirage still keeps the golf course there, but he said to me, and he was very wealthy, like one of the projects I had to work on is he bought a table and chair, and he bought a dinette table and chair, and we had a dispute with the broker. We introduced him to the table and chair, and the broker was upset because he was stiffed on his commission, and his commission for that table and chair was $500,000. So you can tell how valuable the table and chair was. It was subclass Chippendale, something like that. But in any event, he came to me, and we battled forever with the Nevada Gaming Commission to be able to get his gaming license, and they finally gave him a one-year license because he wasn't in gambling, but he manufactured pachinko machines. And he said to me, you know, Mr. Johnson, I'm never coming back to the United States. I hate this place. But so in any event, that's my involvement with pachinko games. But so in any event, you said that also that I guess that Jared Taylor is going to be speaking before that group next year?
That's what their leader, their party leader, Mr. Sakurai, told me. As you know, Jared was brought up in Japan and speaks very good Japanese, and actually, I think, was making his living as a translator, which helped finance his football.
Yeah, that'll be good. You also mentioned to me that flying inside Japan is prohibitively expensive. And
flying inside Canada is expensive.
Well, flying inside Japan is even more expensive.
I didn't know about that. I flew out from Tokyo.
Okay, because in Japan, you fly, you don't fly, you take the bullet trains everywhere you go. The bullet trains are really fast. And a few years ago, I did the legal work to take the Rolling Stones to Japan. And I didn't represent the Rolling Stones, I represented the promoter that hired. I represented the Rolling Stones employer that hired him to go over there. And they required to fly airplanes, everybody to go, brother concerts. And we said, hey, look, you guys, it's a lot more convenient, it's a lot cheaper, it's a lot better to go by train. We can give you a whole car. I mean, you got to fly there, and then you got to get out, and you got to take a cab where you're going. It's crazy to fly. And they said, nope, we want to fly. So, yeah, it's really bad. Flying in Japan is even worse than Canada, I bet. But in any event, let's get down to the topics at hand, because we gotta save the world. This is a sad story about this 13-year-old, this young Barnard, college student, Tessa Major, who was killed by these young black thugs. And the title is, Man Arrested After Threatening to Kill 13-Year-Old Accused of Stabbing Tessa Major. So what's the situation on this?
Well, this guy had the audacity to express on, I think it was Reddit, where he posted something to the effect that he was going to hunt this kid down and kill him. Those aren't the exact words, it's a paraphrase, but got himself in trouble for saying that. I think he was even arrested. So the issue is, what speech can we and can we not say? Another issue that comes to my mind is, I wonder if this sentiment is widespread, more so than we would like to think, or some people would like to think.
What do you think on that issue, Paul?
Now, so he was arrested for saying he'd like to kill her, is that right?
Well, let me quote what he said. He said, "I do believe that black kids murdered her, though." This is before, I guess, they showed the pictures of the images of the kids. That's the real story. Why don't you pay attention to that? A black kid, 13, 14-year-old, stabbed a white girl to death for nothing. Time to exterminate the real problem. Now he was freed by a family lawyer to let loose in Harlem. I'm going to search for him myself tonight, armed and ready to fire. Then parents are next." That's what he said, and that was enough to get him arrested.
I can see why.
Yeah.
That is a direct threat of violence against an individual. He didn't put it in, couch it in terms of, well, we should do this, or if someone did that, it'd be good, you know. He says, "I'm going to go do it." And I can see why the law takes that position. Of course, that's dealing with a small micro issue of someone threatening to kill someone else. It doesn't deal with the larger picture that we need to get these kind of people away from our people because they are killing us. I can see why that would be actionable, because if someone had said, "I'm going to come kill Johnson and his family," I would hope the police would intervene.
So what would happen, Bill, if this guy would follow through on his threat? It turns out, I don't think he even owns any guns, but if he followed through on his threat and the authorities have not intercepted him, not arrested him, ignored it, that is hyperbole, what would happen then?
Then there would be rioting, and all the black communities would be in an uproar because of going after this young teenager who was just trying to get money for school clothes.
Is it conceivably possible that authorities could be held responsible? I mean, is that actionable?
No, they could be held responsible in the court of public opinion, but they cannot be held liable in the court of law because there's immunity on that, you know, so just inaction. And there's been court cases on that. The police are not obligated to protect or to serve. The police are obligated to give citations and to arrest people. So,
and you notice they've taken that off their patrol cars. I don't know about in California, but where I live, all the vehicles used to say to protect and to serve. I don't see that anymore. They took it off.
They're starting to get on. And you know that after in L.A. you had that big Rodney King event where the cops just pounded on Rodney King and sent him to the hospital. And so I remember this one joke, I guess it's Saturday Night Live, that Johnny Carson or whatever said that the LAPD has changed the logo on the side of his car. It no longer says to protect and to serve. It says, "We treat you like a king." I can see, first of all, I read some of these reports on Reddit and on some of these other news compilation sites, and they say, "Oh, it's good, nothing lost, she was just a marijuana-smoking, purple-haired-dyed liberal waiting, you know, going out looking for trouble." But the thing is she was a young girl that had her whole future in front of her, and she went to a bad area that she shouldn't have gone into, and she was killed for it. And that's just tragic to the extreme. And I can see why people would be so upset that they would say that they need to take out this 13-year-old boy. But yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about this in the past. We need to have swift justice. And the swift justice needs to be against this 13-year-old black boy, not against someone who threatens to take him out.
What would have happened 100 years ago if an identical crime had been committed, a black kid stabbed a white woman to death, 18 years old? What would have been the reaction of the white community, do you think?
Outrage, and it would have led to instant action. Either there'd be a quick trial and probably an execution, or in a few cases there'd be a lynching.
I think generally it would have been a swift trial and an execution. And that the same would have happened if a white boy had stabbed the girl. There would have been a swift trial and an execution. So society is broken down, and that's just one example of it. and it's just tragic.
That's one of the problems with the breakdown. There's no resolution. I've read several cases recently of somebody who's been on death row in the United States for 20 years. The victims, or I mean the family of the victims, are in many cases probably dead or very, very old. And even if a person is eventually executed, as was the settlement, people forgot what it was all about. There isn't that sense of resolution that somebody did something very bad. There's a quick trial, and if a person's convicted, there's a sentence, and the sentence is carried out. Now it's appealed till cows come home.
Yeah, justice delayed is justice denied, and it's bad for society. It's bad for society to not have swift and immediate justice. If you had swift and immediate justice, I believe that would be a substantial deterrent to crime. But even if it's not a substantial deterrent for crime, it would be a balm and an assuage to the victim's family.
And you know, there's concern that very low IQ people who commit a lot of murders, they don't anticipate the future, or anticipate consequences. And it's hard to anticipate those things if the execution or resolution is years and years and years in the future. But if there is a reasonable assurance that the person would be tried and found guilty, punished and executed of his murder, that might be a deterrent even for some of the, you know, not mentally very sharp people.
Yeah, I think that's true. Okay, let's go on to another story. I would like to talk to the one about the black pastor who said that he would go to hell to avoid white people.
That's a good idea. Amen, brother.
The thing that caught my attention about this story is, first of all, what he allegedly said. And I found this on the internet, so I was kind of careful because you find stories and they turn out not to be true. But this one, pretty sure it's accurate. But what he is quoted as saying is, frankly, the famine is going to be full of white American evangelicals. I'll take my chances in hell. And when I read that, what occurred to me is this guy saying that white people go to heaven and black people go to hell? That's what it seemed to me. I don't think he thought this through before he did that. But, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think if you take a look at the origin of the word hell, that comes from Scandinavian mythology.
Yeah.
And so, I'm not up on Scandinavian mythology. When I was a kid, we all studied Greek and Roman mythology, and Scandinavian mythology, we studied about Thor, and that was about it. But I believe that, like, wasn't hell like a child of some god that was half alive and half dead, and that eventually evolved into a place where all of the bad people go, and I think Asgard or somewhere is where all the warriors went, or all the women who died in childbirth went.
Valhalla,
yeah, that's what it was, Valhalla. So I think hell is a Norse concept, so in that sense, yes, since up until our current generation, it was the Nordics were white. Now if you look at these movies, the Nordics have come with black people. Been playing these various roles, but I think from that theological perspective, hell would be reserved, and heaven both would be, and how Valhalla would be reserved for our people. If you move it over to the Christian arena, hell is for those who don't believe, and heaven is for those who do believe. So I don't know.
Well, the thing that he's missing here, besides the fact that he's implicating that heaven is a place for white people and hell is for black people, but he's forgetting that, I was a Christian, for what, some 50 years? I was a pastor for 12 years, and I can tell you from the laboratory of life, a lot of white Christians going to hell. So if he thinks going to hell is going to get him away from evangelical white people, he's in for a shock. Because there's probably more of them there than there are in heaven. So you might want to rethink this.
Well, now we're talking talking about Christianity the day before, 2 days before Christmas. So you said that you used to be a Christian, Ken, so you no longer identify as a Christian?
My posture right now is there's nothing supernatural, there never has been anything supernatural, there never will be anything supernatural. Change my mind. I'm working on a book. It should be out in 3 months, and it's called Change My Mind.
Okay. Now, what about you, Santa Claus tie wearer?
I believe in a God. I was brought up a Catholic, and when I do go to church, I go to the very, very conservative, the breakaway church that was formed by Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre against the mayhem that was caused in Vatican II. But I'm not a frequent churchgoer, and I have a fair appreciation of the pre-Christian religions of our European people. It's hard to really categorize me, except I certainly do believe in God.
Yeah. But then, Ken, are you all for celebrating Christmas?
Yes.
Okay.
I celebrate Christmas both from a religious point of view and a cultural point of view. It's part of our culture.
My take on this whole religious thing is that I have attended church my entire life, and I will attend the church my entire life. And I think that there is something really cathartic and beneficial and good about congregating together once a week to try to make yourself a better person. And so I certainly believe in religion. And when you get people in church and they stand up and say, oh, I believe in Jesus Christ, I believe in the fact, strong faith, the church is true and all that kind of stuff, I can look at any church and I can find very good things in it, and I can find very good reasons to congregate every week and try to make yourself a better person. Do I believe, like Ken, in that there's nothing supernatural now or ever, forever? I'm not a theologian. I don't really go there, and I don't really care to go there. I think that there is the gifts of the Spirit include believing on other people's faith, relying on other people's faith. So I really don't argue the point, but I think it's good to get together. I think that all religions have very good things, and I think all religions have things that are not so good. If I were to create a society, would I create a society that would have people to get together on a regular basis to discuss things to make them a better person? Yes. Would I make that Christian? Would I make that pagan? Would I make that Nordic? I don't know, but I think getting together is a good thing. I think celebrating Christmas is a good thing. I've done that the whole time. But when I die, will I be going to Valhalla or hell or heaven? I don't really care. I don't really know. Whatever happens, happens.
I send out Christmas cards, but
I'm quite of a half dead. If you go to hell, that would be like going to Washington, D.C.
Okay, all right. What were you going to say, Ken?
I sent out Christmas cards, but they were all blank.
All blank.
They said Merry, but then you can fill in whatever.
Okay, all right. Well, very good. All right, well, let's, on that ho-ho-ho jolly note.
Yeah, what did you call Paul Fromm a second ago?
Oh, he was the Santa Claus tie wearer.
Not the old something Santa Claus tie wearer, something like that.
Okay, I'm not sure. But in any event, now this okay to be white issue is spreading beyond the college campuses in the United States. It's happening in Perth, Scotland.
Scotland.
Not Perth, Australia. So tell us about that, Ken.
Well, the story is that the signs, I guess they print them on sticky paper, but it's like 8.5 by 11. They say it's okay to be white, and somebody in Perth, Scotland, spread these all over the town, which I guess is a substantial population. I'm wondering how nobody caught it because of the proliferation of video devices that is everywhere now, but they didn't catch them. But the story behind this story is they were roundly condemned by authorities. For example, one guy said they are atrocious, no place in Perth or any part of the country. Somebody else said we must stand together to resist this unacceptable material. Somebody else said, I am certainly worried now for my daughters, who are not white, but are from Perth. Somebody else said, it's sickening and disgusting to know that people think like this, and on and on and on, but nobody explained what was wrong with it. They just said it's evil, but they didn't explain why. I don't think they thought. I think they just reacted because they were programmed to do so.
Well, I think one of the objections that would come from people who are living in a predominantly white society, which is becoming fewer, smaller and smaller and fewer in today's world. But I think what it does, it tries to make the establishment the oppressed. The white establishment is in charge of all of these countries and in charge of oppressing people. And by making the statement, it's okay to be white, it's trying to flip the cards there and say, well, the white people are really the oppressed people, and they have to say this okay. That's their objection, and I can see why they would say that, but my comment is, why are there white non-white children in Perth, Scotland? They should not be in that country, and then there would be problem solved.
That would solve the problem, but that's not what we see.
Yeah, I was taken aback also by the vehemence of the reactions in that story. I think it illustrates just how vulnerable the globalist elite feel they are. That their mortal enemy is the reawakened nationalism of proud white people. Because they know that as long as we're anything near a majority, the their goose is cooked. If we recover our pride, it will make Donald Trump sound like a mealy-mouthed liberal. Of course, build a wall.
What if somebody went all through Singapore or all through Shanghai and put signs up saying it's okay to be white? That even made the news.
Or it's okay to be East Asian.
It might be seen as a little bit eccentric, but in the present world, every group has a right to be proud. You know, they talk about the gay pride parade. I have trouble understanding why one would be proud of the way one performs sex, but okay, gay pride, black pride, Native Indian pride, and so on. But why not white pride? I mean, there's no logical consistency here. The attack on white pride is entirely emotional, and I think the globalists sense it. If people start focusing on what we have to be proud of, we don't have to make up a history like, you know, some of the blacks that they were the people behind the pyramids, and the Greeks ripped off their superior knowledge, etc. We have so much to be genuinely proud about. You know, the tremendous scientific inventions, the inventions and advances in health, the architecture, the music, and so on and so on. We have every right to really throw at our chests with great pride. And you know, once you've got people who are proud, they're not so prepared to be pushed around. And we've been pushed around by the cult of the victim for at least 50 years. I think that's why it has to be stamped on, even though the words themselves, it's okay to be white.
Well, do you guys know the origin of the phrase, it's okay to be white, how it first gained popularity?
My guess is it's something that Bob came up with.
Something that who?
Bob, I forget his last name. He passed away a couple years ago.
Oh, he used to be on the American Freedom Party board, Bob Whitaker,
yeah. It sounds like I don't know. Okay. I'm just guessing, but it sounds like something you come up with.
From what I understand, is there is a bulletin board called 4chan I've looked on it. I can't follow it. It's just a mishmash of a whole bunch of offensive and open source and white, see what happens. And so then a lot of kids, they printed it out, and they started putting it up somewhere. And it gained an immediate, huge backlash by whom? By city governments. Mayors and city councilmen of these towns were up there. They had an apoplectic fit, whatever that word is. And so other people, oh, that's great. So they started doing it, mostly just to be a little bit confrontational and do it anonymously. And that's how it got started. And I think it's growing and growing.
There were a number of those posters on several Canadian campuses that caused a great stir. And actually, I think it's worthwhile for people to do this because it will help alert people. I'm thinking people that there's something desperately wrong. If all these other groups have the right to be proud of who they are, but whites don't, what does that say?
But see, it's not even white pride worldwide. It's way watered down from that. It's okay to be white.
Right.
And so that is as anemic, as limp-wristed as you can get of any saying out there.
But it's still racist, according to the far left, don't you kidding? Now, what's interesting about this is a couple guys did this, and if the media shut up about it, nobody would know it. But the media didn't, and so the small effort of a couple guys probably has been spread around the globe. I mean, this is amazing, the PR that they got out of this. So what would happen if I did this in my hometown? Would we get the same PR? The point is, the far left media just not thinking. Now, I got to throw this in, what comes to my mind. Paul Fromm mentioned the advances in technology, and this is a real topic, from white nations, white people. But did you guys know that Elon Musk is prepared to launch 42,000 satellites for communications? Did you know that? Now that's unprecedented.
Wow. Yeah.
Totally off topic, but I think all the satellites are going to happen to keep me quite on.
Some months ago, one of the groups I'm involved with, the Canadian Association for Free Expression, was an intervener, or I guess in America they call them an amicus curiae, but in a so-called human rights case where a transgendered person took Ray Humbridge at a preacher friend of mine who put out literature during an election saying, well, if this guy can't even get his sex right, you really think he's a suitable representative. Anyway, well, some of the sociological claptrap we had to put up with was the terrible injustice of not accepting that person for who he is, that you're challenging his very identity and saying that he's not really who he thinks he is. In fact, we don't think he is who we think he is. But anyway, that notion of you've got a right to your dignity and identity, what does it say when people are practically foaming at the mouth with rage at a poster that says it's okay to be white? Does that mean it's not okay to be white? Which means somehow we don't have any legitimacy as white people. I mean, that's absurd.
That is what they're saying. Why post those posters?
That would be like we have less right to exist than a cockroach.
I think that the larger issue and why it creates such a reaction on such a grand scale is that what happens if people put up these posters, it's okay to be white, and a mayor came out and said, I like that, there's nothing wrong with that. Or a governor came out and said, okay, there's nothing wrong with that, I like that. Of course, it won't happen, no mayor will ever do that, no governor will ever do that, but you know who might come out and do that?
Donald Trump.
And that's why everybody's trying to teach him, because he's that loose cannon kicking out there saying, hey, I'm white, my kids are white. Yeah, I like that. You know, just like he said, when he says America first, he says, you can't do that. I'm nationalist. You can't do that. See, now, it's okay to be white. I can see him coming out, hey, guys, it's okay to be white. So that's why.
I'm hoping you're right here. although you know, people on our side of the fence call have a lot of criticisms of Trump, and I'm certainly not blind to some of his shortcomings, especially in Israel. But you know, he moved the ball a long way down the field when he said a lot of these people coming into Mexico are these illegals, are rapists and murderers, and we don't need them. Well, you can't say that. You can't say that's generalization. That's unjust. Trump is through. He'll never get anywhere near the nomination. Well, he kept on saying it. Got the nomination. Well, he can't say those things about immigrants. He kept saying that. He can never be president. I'm sure he can, and he did. And I just think it takes a certain amount of courage. Sure, initially, that there'll be a howl of denunciation. And, but I think, you know, a small town there said, yeah, I'm proud of my origin. I have other people have a right to be proud of theirs too, but I'm proud of being white. Sure, there'll be initially, you know, denunciations and so on, but I have a feeling most people will go along with that.
Well, who is the congressman that took that posture? I can't think of his name.
King.
Yep.
It was King. And he voted to censure himself. The outrage was so outstanding against him that when they censured people on Capitol Hill for Congress, he voted to censure himself. It was so contrite.
Because on other, I mean, he's outspoken, I think fairly clear thinking, and so on. But how can you be so traumatized that you, it's like voting for your own execution?
Well, yes, I think that's the way they phrased the, was it legislation, what do they call it?
A censure.
Yeah, but...
censure.
Yeah. The way they phrased it.
I got a Christmas card from, well, actually I got a Christmas card from Vice President Pence, and he sent out, personally signed it, and it was sent out by his staff, and he paid first class stamp on it, and it was because of connections that I have. But I also got one from Donald Trump, which was just sent out mass mailing. But both of them, if you open it up, it was Merry Christmas inside. And Donald Trump was particularly Merry Christmassy on his Christmas card. And that's the first time this happened in a while. And so I could see in the future, and a Christmas card say, it's okay, it's Merry Christmas, it's okay to be white. You know, or, you know, something like that. Because he could do that. And that's why we hope that he will keep going, and that's why the opposition is so vitriolic in trying to stop him.
Another dimension to this story that I think deserves mentioning is that this is spread because of the internet. Nobody would have known about this meme, this mantra, had it not been for the internet. Now, when I think about that, prior to the internet, when was that, late 90s, mid-90s, I didn't know there was anybody out there that thought like, I didn't know you guys, I didn't know anybody who had the same mindset that I had. But once the internet came online, there was Facebook, there was YouTube. I mean, there are people all over the place. It's just, it's unbelievable.
There is in Los Angeles, or there was in Los Angeles, all of these magazine shops. And I used to go to the largest magazine shop it was in Sherman Oaks, which is in the valley, San Fernando Valley. And there would be, it would be lined with 100 magazines, everything from poodle shearing today to, you know, to growing cannabis in your backyard. But in that entire, hundreds of magazines, there was not one pro-white magazine. And so what you're saying, Ken, is true. If the internet allowed these digital magazines to come on board, and so we can find each other. And of course, you read about how Twitter and Facebook and Google are all trying to shut us down. But you know, I think it's like you say, the Pandora's box is open, and all the little pro-white gremlins are escaping. So maybe
I'm not a follower of the Fuhrer principle. I don't think we have somehow find a one leader that's going to, you know, save us. But that's not to say that leadership doesn't have a role. I remember at the very end of the 2016 election campaign in the States, Donald Trump spoke at a number of rallies, and he ended up with, and this year it's going to be Merry Christmas. And the crowd went crazy with applause. And I thought, beginning something. And even up here in the land of super political correctness, that we must be almost as politically correct as the Swedish establishment. I've got two Christmas cards this year from politicians who actually wrote Christmas. One is a conservative member of the provincial legislature, and it was Merry Christmas and picture of his family and all that. And the other is my liberal member of parliament. And her card, she's Italian, her card says, Merry Christmas. I'm nearly cruel. I think there, you know, there really is a movement that, and people who 10 years ago would have said, like many of our commercial enterprises, that no, we need to be inclusive. And all of that was a flabbergasting. How are we being inclusive by excluding ourselves? But anyway, I think that the message is getting to at least some politicians that, hey, it's okay. And I put that down to considerable extent to Donald Trump's leadership.
Well, I got a Christmas card today from a politician that is very Christian. You got a picture of an angel on the front blowing a horn to welcoming in the baby Jesus, and it says, wishing you a joyous Christmas season. And this is from elected official on a major city council. You know where it was? It's from Chiba, Japan. So they'll do it in Japan. And in fact, I'm going to have to write it back. In fact, I think I was writing an email to him just before I had to go on the show, because I'm going to try to get him to get me some tickets to the Tokyo Olympics that's coming up in August. Because you can't get any tickets; they're all sold out. So I'm saying, thank you for your Christmas card, Mr. City Councilman. By the way, my family wants to go to Tokyo for the Olympics. Can you get us some tickets? But in any event.
While you're at it, you're also going to have to ask for some affordable accommodation. I think July and August, only millionaires will even be able to stay at the Salvation Army if they have.
Oh, I've got clients who offer me houses, full houses. I can take all of my family and we'll all be able to stay in one house. There's no problem about housing. It's getting those darn tickets that's going to be a problem. But yeah, in any event, it is coming around. Donald Trump is making inroads. And I talked to some of the nationalists involved when Donald Trump first got elected, white nationalists, or when he was nearing election, and many of them were opposed to Donald Trump. They did not like him. And now, after 2 years, they're coming around and really like him. Some of them are going the other direction because they're caught up on some of these little things that he's done. But he's just one man fighting everything. And he's not one of us. He's not a white nationalist. And so you got to look for benefits and progress where we can. And so, but a lot of white nationalists are really becoming Trump supporters. And so there's hope. There's hope that he's, like you say, he's moved the ball a lot farther downfield than anybody else in the past 100 years.
You know, I was listening to one of the chattering classes the other day here in Canada, and this person actually made some sense. He was talking about the recent British election, where Boris Johnson's Conservatives broke what they call the red wall, which is working class riding right across the north and middle of England, and they've been labor strongholds for back to the 30s, and he won a number of seats there, and what the commentator said was. That Labour had drifted a long way away from the concerns of the British working man, which were not—they were not socialists, they were not communists. They were fairly traditional in terms of the family and patriotism. And he made the point that this was the same thing Donald Trump had done. Donald Trump won. We call them Blue Belt states.
Rust Belts.
Michigan that had been fairly predictably Democratic. And he did that by addressing the concerns of the working man, mostly the white working man, who'd been largely forgotten, his values mocked, by a new elite that's, you know, radically for, you know, carbon taxes and fighting global warming and LGBTQ. And, you know, I thought a turning point in the last American election was when Hillary Clinton went to West Virginia, which had been a predictably Democratic state, and told them she wasn't going to do anything for their coal mines. In other words, you people were being unemployed, and I don't care. I thought, that doesn't sound very smart. And, we, you know, we all know the results.
But she was honest. I mean, she was, you know, from the abundance of the heart to mouth speaking. She was just, she let this little, she let her guard down. She was actually honest for change.
Well, what we have is we have captains of industry and big business have exploited people for their own gain for centuries. I mean, it used to be that union busters would get out there, big business would get out there and just destroy the unions, people from advocating to get a living wage. And that's why there were union busters. And that's why, like, just in downtown Los Angeles in 1910, you had the McCormick brothers bombed. They were members of the iron workers. And it used to be that back then, there were like 100 or so bombings that took place, protest against these union-busting big corporations. And they bombed the Los Angeles Times. And before those other bombings, there was no damage, very little damage. It was not a big deal. But the Los Angeles Times building, they put the dynamite next to barrels of ink. And that exploded. They got on fire, and it burned down all of the Los Angeles Times building, and it killed like 25 workers. And they had done that because Otis Chandler, or Mr. Otis had opposed unionization for 50 years. And so back then, if you read what the people were saying, the socialist, Eugene Debs, I don't know what you know, is he ran...
Not quite sure why this is...
As a socialist for president for five times. He was saying it was caused by the LA Times. They deserve it. And then you had Muckraker by the name of Lincoln Stebbins, I guess. He was in the kitchen cabinet of Woodrow Wilson. He came and said it was justifiable dynamiting. You know, why? Because big business was so out to oppress the worker, the working man, that the working man had to fight back. And then and Clarence Darrow came to town, and he handled the case, and the McCormick brothers were sentenced to prison for a long period of time. But the point is, these workers were protesting against big business and their destructive behavior. And now what's happening now? Everybody's unionized. The union were working for to get a fair wage, and everyone's pushing to get a fair wage. So what does big business do? Let's bring in immigrants from around the world for cheap labor. So big business has and always will be the enemy of the working white man. That's my soapbox for a while. And in the other countries, like in Japan, you have the heads of the corporations, their wages will be five times the earnings of the average factory worker. What are the wages of the captains of industry in the United States? 1,000 times the factory workers. It is unfair, it is improper, and it is destroying the West, it is destroying our race.
And I agree. I believe 50 years ago, the average company president earned 67 times what the average worker did, which was a pretty big differential. Today, I think it's 200 and some, I mean, it's some astronomical amount.
And back then, if you take a look back in this L.A. Times bombing area of 1910, the L.A. Times passed a law just before the bombing saying that you cannot raise your voice on a public street or you will get 50 days in jail. Why did they do that? They were stopping the union organizers from standing on a soapbox in the public street saying, L.A. Times, you're being unfair. Factory owners, you're being unfair. So what did the LA City Council do? 50 days in jail if you raise your voice in public. And so what happened? they bombed the LA Times, and it served them right. That's my comment.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago, I told the story of having met Bill Rusher just before he retired as publisher of National Review, which had become very useless. But Bill Rusher was, you know, once, you know, quite the icon in the conservative movement, and I very gingerly asked Art Rusher, well, your country's immigration policy is bringing about fundamental changes. In America will no longer be so European. And what he said to me, floored me. He said, well, yes, it will become a little more browner, but the Mexicans who are coming up here have good family values, you know, and it will really screw the unions. And I thought, you're prepared to accept the replacement of your people to screw the unions? I mean, your values are depraved.
Oh, I know. That's the mindset of the big business conservative. But it's changing around. I was just looking on the internet today, and like Ken says, you find anything on the internet, there was a picture that says, these guys are the traitors. Picture of treason. It was a picture of treason, and you looked at it, and it was a picture of LBJ sitting at the dock outside of the Statue of Liberty, signing the Hart-Celler Act, or whatever it's called, allowing immigration to come in. And so, in America, people were saying, this is treason. And yet, LBJ up there committing treason in front of for all of us to read. And so, times are changing. It might be coming too late for us to do anything about it. But there's a spark of hope there.
Or the iconic photograph of FDR sitting with Joseph Stalin. And to me, that's gut-wrenching to watch that. I mean, you see that?
Really? They're on the same playing field. They were comrades in arms. I think it's, I look at that and I say, oh,